I think we start anyway. Welcome to this afternoon's session, the first one after lunch. This will be about anti-censorship and transparency on the internet, which is a very interesting topic. Some of you might have been on the yesterday's session about human rights and the internet, and some of the questions that was brought up there is very, very accurate for this kind of for this presentation today, because the internet, as we say in the program, it has proved to be tremendous potential for the enjoyment of freedom of expression and information, as well as any other human rights you can think of. It's also an important channel that makes it possible for us to communicate and interact without border limits. There are, however, strong powers trying to block or stop or filter different kind of activities, as well as powers to protect openness. And that is why I am especially proud to introduce to you Roger Dingeldine, the project leader of the Tor project. Please. He's working on anonymity research and development at the Tor project.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Is my mic on? Sounds great. Okay. And my slides are up. Perfect. So I'm Roger Dingeldine from Tor, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what Tor is and who uses it. These are actually four different talks that I've sort of smushed into one talk. So everybody will be hopefully happy with something and disappointed with not hearing enough about other things. Feel free to interrupt me during the talk if you've got a question. I hear there are two people with microphones wandering around. There's one who just raised your hand here, and there might be, and there's another one over here. So there are microphones, and if you've got a question, raise your hand, get their attention from one of them, break in, and we can make this about what you want to talk about and hear about as well. So Tor is a bunch of different things. Tor is a free software program that you can get and use and install on your computer. And the goal is that you can get to places like websites or other internet services where somebody watching you locally can't figure out what service you're going to, and somebody at the service end can't figure out where you're coming from, and no single part of the infrastructure in the middle can link you to where you're going. And I'll get into some examples of that in a little bit. So first of all, it's software. Second of all, Tor is a network of volunteers around the world. There are about 2,000 people who are relaying traffic for a bunch of Tor users. And it's also a protocol. We have a specification like the internet draft that says, if you build your protocol, if you build your program like this, then you'll be compatible with the other Tor systems out there. So two groups in Germany built their own compatible Tor clients. There was a fellow at Yale University who did. Somebody in Canada just built a Tor client. So part of the goal is we specify it well enough that researchers can look at it and decide whether it's actually built the right way, and maybe line 17 over here, you need to change it to do this in order to be safer. It's also a community of researchers, developers, operators around the world. One of the neat things about Tor from a research perspective, 15 years ago, everybody who was writing research papers on anonymity would say, theoretically, this attack should work, and then they would write about theory, or theoretically, this defense should work, and then they would write about the theory of defense. Now Tor is actually deployed, and it's out there, so all of the attack papers actually try the attacks on Tor, and all of the defense papers actually try modifying Tor to show that the defense works better. Most of the attack papers are the ones that get published, because the research world, especially for graduate students, encourages people to write attack papers because they're short and easy to do, and it discourages defense papers because it takes a lot longer to show that your system actually is safer now. So most grad students break Tor, and it's up to us to fix it, which, I mean, I guess I'm happy that they're breaking it. I wish more people would help us fix it. One of the other things about Tor that's also neat is the diversity of funding that we've got over the years. Tor actually started out as a U.S. Naval Research Lab project, so funded by the Department of Defense. And from there, we were funded by a civil liberties nonprofit in California called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And from there, we were funded by another U.S. group called the International Broadcasting Bureau. You haven't heard of them by that name, but you've probably heard the phrase Voice of America or Radio Free Cuba stuff like that. So they care about the privacy anonymity stuff, but they also care about the reachability sort of thing. We'll get in a few more slides to the whole circumvention, censorship, what if governments try to block your access to the web sort of thing. So that's what Tor is as a program. Tor is also a nonprofit that we started in 2006. It's an actual U.S. 501c3. So we've got two main goals. The first goal is I want to build tools that will keep everybody safe on the internet for a wide variety of definitions of safe. And then the second one, I want to teach everybody around the world what it means to be safe on the internet and how to think about and evaluate tools that they get. So, for example, SSL, we need everybody to have a good intuition about what the difference between HTTPS and HTTP is, and if you're in one situation, what that offers you and what it doesn't offer you. And a lot of the funding we've got recently is looking from the government angle, but we also had some funding from various European governments. A lot of European governments that fund Tor don't really want to be publicly associated with helping to save the world. That's yet another challenge of how do we explain to them that actually it's good to be associated with that. And then Tor has some number of users. I'm not really sure how many because it's an anonymity system, but I'm guessing somewhere more than 100,000 people are running Tor clients right now and somewhere less than a million. So somewhere around the 500,000 mark. Mozilla tracks its users of Firefox extensions much more thoroughly than maybe it should. And at one point, they gave us a number of 450,000 people are trying to update their Tor button Firefox extension on a given day. So that's some vague estimate of how many users there are. Okay, so let's take a step back here. What sort of threat model are we looking at? As security people, the first question we should ask is what are we trying to do and what risks are there and what's the model we're looking at? So we've got some Alice over here. She's trying to browse the web. She's some user in Sweden or the US or Afghanistan or some other place. And she's trying to get to some web service Bob website, for example. And then there's some attacker in between. So where can the attackers be? The attacker could be watching Alice's local network. Maybe the attacker is Telia. Maybe the attacker is the monopoly telephone company in Morocco watching all of their users. Or maybe the attacker is on the Bob end. Maybe the attacker is watching the network connection for WikiLeaks because they really want to know who all the users are who are reaching it or stuff like that. Or maybe the attacker is Bob. Maybe the attacker is CNN.com. And they really want to know who all the users are so that they can advertise to them better. They want to be able to track where the users are coming from and recognize them in the future. Or maybe the attacker is somewhere in the middle. Maybe it's one of the big ISPs like AT&T or Deutsche Telekom or somebody watching the cables that go across the Atlantic. So there are a lot of different places that the attacker could be. If the attacker is in all of these red boxes, then we're screwed. We can't protect against that level of adversary. And we'll get in a little bit to what we can do and what we can't do. So far, so good? Am I going too fast, too slow? I see some nods of heads. Sounds great. Okay, so anonymity is not crypto. I talk to a lot of corporations who say, I don't need this Tor thing because I use a VPN, so I'm all set, thanks. And encryption is good. You should use encryption. But even when you're using encryption, somebody watching the traffic gets to figure out who you're talking to, how much you're saying, when you're talking to them. And that's, nobody tries to break encryption anymore. If you're an intelligence agency and you're trying to figure out who's doing what and who's interesting to look at, step one is build the social network, who talks to who, who's in the middle, who's the person always being talked to, and then you break into their house and install a wiretap or some other approach where you try to figure out what's going on with them. So nobody tries to break the encryption. It's all about let's watch the traffic and learn from that who is interesting. And then there are some other versions of anonymity that we try to be stronger than. There are a bunch of peer-to-peer file sharing designs out there. Freenet is one of them, but there are a bunch of other ones that are based on the plausible deniability notion. Yes, you asked me for the file, and yes, I gave you the file, but it might not have been me. I might have been relaying it for somebody else. You can't prove it was me. So there are a couple of problems with that. The first problem is, what happens the 40th time you're the guy involved in that transaction? Yeah, you asked me the file. Yeah, I'm the one who gave it to you again, but you can't prove it was me. There might be some jurisdictions where I don't care about proving after a certain point, it looks pretty suspicious. And then the other problem is, what if we're talking about people in China or Kazakhstan or something like that, and we've narrowed it down to 8 people, but we can't prove which of those 8 it was in court? I don't care. Round up all 8 of them, put them all in jail. So we want something where it's not about plausible deniability. It's not about, I think it was you, but I can't be certain. We want something where there's a lot of diversity of users, so it's not possible to narrow it down to these 6 people, and we're not sure which of those 6 it was. And then there's the single hop proxy approach. There are a lot of corporations out there that provide guaranteed anonymity. And the way it works is they've got one computer somewhere, you route all the traffic through that one computer, and they say, we promise we won't look at any of the traffic. Okay, we look at all of it. We promise we won't write anything down. We promise we won't remember the traffic. Okay, we log everything. We promise we won't tell anybody what comes out. And I don't know what the 4th line is there, but I want something stronger than that. I was actually talking to the CTO of one of these anonymizer companies a few years ago, and he said, we never answer subpoenas. If we ever answered a subpoena, our users would never trust us again. So of course we never answer subpoenas. Then I was doing a talk for the U.S. Department of Justice a few months ago, and one of them broke in partway through and said, why can't you be like Anonymizer? It's great. We send them a subpoena. They send us an answer. Why can't you be like that? So I'm not sure which side was bluffing or lying to me. Maybe they were both telling the truth in their own world. But our goal is to have something that's based on the technology, not based on promises. It's not about, I could screw you, but I promise not to. It's about an architecture where there is no point in the system that gets to learn about Alice and Bob. It's not a matter of, I do know, but I promise not to tell somebody. I want a system where nobody knows. Okay, so I actually only use the word anonymity when I'm talking to researchers. When I'm talking to my parents and grandparents, I tell them I'm working on a privacy system. When I'm talking to Google and Walmart and other corporations, I work on communication security or network security. It's the same stuff. It's the same security properties. It's the same network. You want to get all these users into the same place. But if you go to a corporation and you say, I've got privacy for you, they say, I heard 10 years ago that privacy's dead. Why are you trying to give me privacy? Whereas if you say, I've got communication security for you, then they're really excited about it. And then another way of phrasing it, when we go to governments and law enforcement, I work on traffic analysis-resistant communication networks. Again, it's exactly the same system, the same security properties, but it just depends how you figure out how to phrase it for them. And then there's the 4th category we learned about in the past few years, which is people who, they don't mind the security properties, but it's really about reachability. It's about, I can't get to BBC unless I'm using some sort of tool that lets me get around my government firewall. So the challenge of Tor is how do we bring all these different groups into the same network in order to let them blend together? Okay, so there are 4 pieces to today's talk. The first one is a little bit more detail about those types of users, who uses Tor and why and what they care about. Then the second piece is the Tor design in a nutshell, how we actually get the anonymity, what level of protection we can provide, what we can be safe against. And then the third piece is some more stories about places like China and Iran and how Tor has been faring in that sort of environment. And then the last piece is we've been collecting data about the Tor network, performance, scalability, stuff like that. And we've also started some research problems on how to collect aggregated data about Tor users, such as how many users do we have? How many users do we have from China? Is that number going up or down? How do we collect this information in a way that doesn't put anybody at risk, which is a challenging research piece. Okay, so the first piece, a little bit more detail. I'm going to blow through most of these pretty quickly so that we have time for questions, and then we'll see where it goes. So some examples of various Alices who care about anonymity. Let's imagine sick Alice. So let's say your mom has diabetes, and you're not really sure what that is going to mean for you or for her, and your network connection at home isn't very good, so you check out what diabetes means from work. And then somebody watches your network connection because that's what the IT people are supposed to do. And they say, wait a minute, he's going to cost me more in healthcare next year. I better fire him now. And in the U.S., this happens all the time. In Europe, it's not supposed to happen because your healthcare is supposed to be better than ours. But I was hearing from somebody a story about Finland, where somebody got fired because they had some health issue that came out because of some database somebody looked at. So this sort of thing happens all around the world, and it's kind of it would be a shame if that actually were to happen to you. Wouldn't it be nice if you had some way to be safer on the internet? Or another example, consumer Alice. Let's say you look at car racing books on Amazon, and you don't buy anything, you just look at them. Now, 3 years from now, you go to buy car insurance, and your insurance company says, do you like to race cars? And you say no, and they say, what about those books you looked at on Amazon 3 years ago? Is that crazy talk? It sounds crazy. I mean, why would surely nobody will correlate their databases this well. Except, I mean, we'll find out in 3 years whether this happens or not. So part of my goal is to give people tools that let them decide how much of their personal information they want to put into these huge corporate databases that then end up reselling the data or losing it because they can't secure it or having it subpoenaed or they go out of business and sell it to somebody and so on. Or 8-year-old Alice. Let's say your daughter logs into an instant messaging chat room and you've trained her very well. You've said, don't tell anybody what your real name is. Don't tell anybody what your address is. Don't tell anybody what city you live in. Before she says anything, she broadcasts her IP address to everybody else in the chat room. It's not so hard to turn an IP address into a set of geolocation coordinates where in the world that IP address is. And that's getting better and better these days because there are so many companies that are trying to do really targeted, focused advertising. So we take the geolocation coordinates and we turn that into a Google satellite photograph of your house using Google. So before she says anything, I can see whether there's a car parked out front of your house or not. That's fundamentally broken. By default, the internet should be providing some level of security, privacy, anonymity, and then you can choose on top of that what information you want to reveal about yourself. You shouldn't be broadcasting everything about yourself every time you do anything, whether you know it or not. So then there are some examples over here of the various websites. There's the Intuitive Hostel. I'm an advertising company. I collect data and I sell it. Very simple. But then there's the more subtle, I had the logs and I sent them across the country and I don't know where they are anymore. I'm very sorry. And then the other tricky thing is the network can track these things also. I was talking to some ISP company a while ago. I don't remember if it was Comcast or Verizon. And apparently they sell aggregated click logs of all of their users. And it's not very targeted users, so they only get 40 cents per user per month. But actually there are 10 different companies that buy it. So $4 per month per user of free money. I mean, why not aggregate your users' click logs and sell them? And I guess one answer is there are privacy laws against it, but I don't think that that actually stops anybody from doing that in Europe or in the U.S. So those are the individual sides of things. Corporations also care about anonymity, privacy, security for the same reasons, but they phrase things differently. For example, I want to check out the competition's website, and I don't want them to learn that I'm the one doing it. Before I was working on Tor, I worked at a startup, and one of my jobs each day was to go through the web logs and send a summary to the salespeople so that they could call the person back the next day and say, hey, I'm so-and-so from this company. It looks like you spent 8.5 minutes looking at this product page yesterday. Can I tell you more? They quickly learn not to phrase it that way because that really freaks people out. But that's how business works these days. You track everything you possibly can, and you monetize it somehow. Okay, so what about the compromised network perspective? Where does Ford buy its tires? Does Toyota want to know that? Is that the sort of thing you want to be broadcasting everywhere you go? IBM runs a patent database. So if you're thinking about patenting anything in the U.S., you go tell IBM who you are and what you're thinking about patenting. Brilliant move on their part. Monster.com. Let's imagine all the engineers at Cisco are looking for a new job today. So they all go to Monster and they say, this is my position at Cisco and these are my skills and I need a job. Does Monster use that information? Do they sell it? Do they go to the stock market and short the Cisco stock? Nobody knows. So far, so good. And then law enforcement also cares about this stuff. I've been doing more and more talks for the FBI. I did a talk to two Swedish law enforcement in May. I did a talk to a bunch of detectives in Germany and a bunch of law enforcement people in Norway. So there are more and more law enforcement people around the world who are using Tor. Pretty much every talk I do these days, somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, I use Tor every day for my job. Thank you. So, for example, I want to investigate a website, and I really don't want FBI.gov to show up in the web logs, or I want to do a sting operation. Turns out if you show up in a chat room and you say, I'm 8 years old, I really want to meet you on the street corner, and you show up with a .mil address, it doesn't work so well. So they need some sort of way of being safe. Or anonymous tips. Turns out the CIA runs this thing called the Iraqi Rewards Program. And the idea is you're in Baghdad, you see somebody set up a roadside bomb, so you go to the internet cafe and you click on, I want to submit an anonymous tip. So I'm sure the CIA remembers your IP address and learns what they can out of it. But the worst thing is somebody watching your network connection in Baghdad sees you sending data to CIA.gov. And they see exactly what you're submitting. So wouldn't it be nice if these people had the ability to control their own anonymity, to control whether they were getting protection, rather than relying on their network or the website that they're going to keep them safe. And then governments care about the same stuff for the same reasons, but they phrase things differently. What would you bid for a list of Baghdad IP addresses that get email from .gov, or whatever the Swedish equivalent of that is? Does anybody else out there care about this sort of thing? Is that the sort of thing you want to keep secret? Another interesting example, there's a U.S. military guy who still works on Tor from the Naval Research Lab. He's a researcher. And he gets all sorts of training whenever he goes out of the country. Don't wear your Yankees baseball cap. Don't wave your American flag. Don't shout out, I love America. He gets no training. Don't log in directly to your Navy.mil email account. So that means he's followed all the other rules correctly, but he goes up to his hotel room, he checks his mail. Anybody watching the hotel network connection says, room 806, U.S. Navy guy. Is that the sort of thing he wants to be broadcasting everywhere? What does the FBI Google for? Google knows. The FBI's ISP knows. Major telephone companies in the middle know, like AT&T. I guess that means NSA knows. What other organizations get to keep track of this sort of thing? And does anybody even, I mean, do your large corporate or military or government organizations care about the fact that all your traffic is going to some American corporation who sells it and doesn't tell you? Journalists and activists also care about this same stuff for the same reasons. I actually wrote this slide first for a Department of Justice talk, and I wrote journalists and dissidents need Tor, and they got really angry. And then I changed it to activists, and they were totally fine with it. So it's really all about the phrasing of these things again. So for example, let's imagine you've got activists or whistleblowers, and your local ISP is being monitored. So they want to know, are you the one who just connected to Blogspot and made that blog post appear? Or maybe the website end is monitored. Maybe somebody goes to Google and says, tell us the owner of this particular blog account. Or LiveJournal is another fun example. A few years ago, so LiveJournal has a thriving Russian activist community. So if you live in Russia and you think your government should be different, then you've got a LiveJournal account and you're talking about it there. A few years ago, a really rich guy in Moscow bought all of the advertisements on LiveJournal.com. So every time you load any page on LiveJournal, you tell him who you are and which page you just loaded. Nobody cared, whatever. It's just advertisements. A few years after that, another really rich guy in Moscow bought LiveJournal.com. So now KGB runs LiveJournal, and it's got a Russian activist community, and they won't move because there's too much momentum to stay where they are. Or the China situation. A couple of years ago, there was a user of Yahoo.cn, and they did something that China didn't like. So China went to Yahoo and said, tell us who your user is. And Yahoo said, why, certainly, you're a government. I follow the laws of all governments. Here's your user. And that got a lot of people in the U.S. angry because shouldn't you be not following the requests of certain governments? So they brought Microsoft and Cisco and Google and Yahoo in front of Congress and started yelling at them about how they weren't supposed to be helping China oppress its citizens. And at that point, Cisco gave a quote that still really bothers me, but nobody else seems to mind. So they were pushing Cisco on, why did you give the China firewall all of this stuff? And Cisco said, we don't give China anything that we don't sell to everybody else. Which Congress was like, okay, that sounds great. Good answer. Fair enough. And other people are like, oh my God, you sell that to everybody. What are you doing? How can you live with yourself as a corporation? But that's how most of these corporations work. So we'll get to that one in a few more slides also. Or maybe Alice is blocked from reaching certain websites. Maybe you're in Iran and you want to get to Twitter today and tell people what you just saw down the street or where the protest is, or you want to learn what other people have been saying. Or maybe the network is monitored. It's not filtered. Maybe you're in Saudi Arabia where they censor a lot of stuff, but there's a lot of stuff they don't censor. Saudi Arabia has enough people to actually go through the magazines you get and black out the parts of the people you're not supposed to be looking at. So imagine how many people they have to look at internet traffic going back and forth. So I know some people in Saudi Arabia who say, yeah, I could type in that URL and it might work. I might get to the website, but if it does, somebody's going to learn that I'm the one who went there, and eventually they're going to tell my parents, and my father's going to beat me for trying to go to this URL. So I don't care if it works. I'm not going to type that into my browser. Are you crazy? So there are a lot of variations on how this censorship sort of thing works. It's not just there's a piece of hardware in the middle that blocks you, and you either get around it or you don't. So far, so good? So the big picture is you can't get anonymity by yourself. You need to have all these different groups blending into the same system. You can't have the cancer survivors anonymity system, or everybody would know why you're using it, and then you wouldn't be as safe as you were hoping for. So anonymity loves company. And then, yes, bad people need anonymity too. But if you're willing to break the law, there are a lot of other ways that you can get good anonymity online than better, different than Tor can provide. For example, you should steal a mobile phone and use it and throw it away. Or you should break into computers in China or Korea or Norway and route through them. Or you could use the open wireless down the street and then do some of the other steps. So a brief taxonomy of bad people on the internet. Step one, you start with your Trojans and your viruses and your exploits. From there, you build your bot networks or your zombie networks with 10,000 or 100,000 or a million compromised Windows computers around the world. And from there, you profit. The sky's the limit. Spam, DDoS, espionage, extortion. The bad guys are doing great. So part of the challenge that Tor has is the good guys, not just individuals, but corporations, law enforcement, governments, don't have good options, and the bad guys are doing great in terms of safety. So another way of looking at that, scenario one, I want to build a system that works for a million people. It's going to work a year from now, and I can tell you how it works. That's Tor's challenge. Scenario two, I want to build a system that's going to keep 20 people safe for the next 2 weeks, and I'm not going to tell you about it. That's the problem that terrorist organizations have, for example. Scenario two is a lot easier than scenario one. There are so many cute little tricks you can do, like I'm going to start a flame war on Wikipedia and we'll all go read what I say, or I'm going to do an eBay post and it'll take 2 weeks for them to notice. One of the stories about the 9/11 hijackers was somebody walked into a library, logged into a Hotmail account, drafted a mail but didn't send it, and then walked out. Somebody else walked into a different library, logged into the same Hotmail account, pulled up the draft. No email was sent, so no email was logged. I'm told that that actually isn't what happened in that case, but it's a good example of a cute trick, and there are an infinite number of cute tricks like this. Whereas Tor's goal is we want something that I can tell you what my cute trick is, and it still works for a million people, and it's still going to work down the road. So do you buy that? So often there's at least one person in the audience who's jumping up and down saying, but what about bad people? Aren't you helping to destroy the world? So I'm not sure which person that is. I'll find out after the talk, perhaps. Any questions so far? I see some nodding head, but no actual questions. I'll let you keep thinking of them and try to say more controversial things. Okay, so how do you actually build one of these? The easy answer is you have a computer somewhere in the middle, and everybody proxies their traffic through that one computer. And if you're really lucky, you've got encryption over here, so somebody watching Alice One's network connection doesn't get to see what page she's asking for, but the big bad guy in the middle does. There's a centralized point of failure where you ask for his logs, or you buy his logs, or you get a job as the janitor, or he goes out of business and then you inherit it. There are a lot of different ways that a central point of failure can fail. But it's worse than that, because typically it's one computer with a wire going in, and it's the same wire going out. So if I can see the traffic coming into that box and the traffic going out of that box, then statistics are really good these days at being able to match up which flow goes to which. So if I see a flow going in and I see a flow with the same timing and volume characteristics going out, then I can say, aha, this Alice is talking to this Bob. And the math on that is getting scarily good these days. So the goal of Tor is to distribute the trust over multiple hops, so no single relay gets to learn about both Alice and Bob. So that means if R1 is bad, if he's trying to figure out what's going on, he knows Alice is using Tor, he just doesn't know what she's doing. And if R3 is bad, he knows somebody is talking to Bob, but he doesn't know who is talking to Bob. And if they're both bad, if R1 and R3 are collaborating, then we're screwed. Then R1 sees a traffic flow, R3 sees the same traffic flow, and they can learn that it's this Alice talking to this Bob. So that means that the security that the Tor network can provide depends on the diversity and dispersal of these purple boxes up here. The more relays we have and the more different places in the world they're located, the fewer attackers are in a position to be able to be big enough to see the right place. So another way of phrasing that is, we assume that the math is trivial if you can see the traffic on both sides. So we need to make it so that Tor is large enough and diverse enough that very few attackers can be able to see the traffic on both sides. And then there's encryption, but I won't really talk about that much today. A couple of things to point out. So the way this works, Alice makes a connection to R1, and she establishes a session key with that. And then she says, dear R1, please extend this to R2. And then she establishes a session key with R2 that R1 doesn't know. And then she says, R2, please connect this to R3. So Alice ends up with three different session keys, one for each of these relays she's using. And this means that she can communicate with R3 without R1 and R2 being able to read the traffic. All they know is, I can't read this, I'm supposed to send it on to the next guy. So the first thing is, Alice can talk to R3 safely. So she can say, please connect me to CNN.com port 80. The second thing is, if you log the traffic going between any of these, the type of crypto we use provides a property called perfect forward secrecy, which means even if you log the stuff, if you show up the next day to R2 and say, I know you can decrypt this because it went through you, so decrypt it for me, there's nothing R2 can do. He threw away the key yesterday. There's no way for him to decrypt it at this point. The other thing to point out, these white lines over here are not encrypted. Tor does not magically encrypt the internet. This is very confusing to a lot of users because Tor provides encryption inside the Tor network, anywhere between Tor to Tor, but whatever you send to CNN.com is whatever you put into Tor. So if you want encryption, then you should use SSL. You should use HTTPS. And this is challenging for a number of reasons. One of them is that a bunch of websites like Slashdot don't support SSL, and I think Facebook at this point, it may support SSL the whole way, but I think it only supports SSL for your login, which means that Facebook does not support letting you be safe on the internet. So, I mean, if you log into Facebook from your Starbucks cafe or something, then you're screwed. And if you log into Slashdot, it doesn't support SSL at all. So if you're doing that over Tor, you are equally screwed. Tor does not magically secure things. And this is tricky because part of my job is to explain to users about this whole encryption, security, what you get, what you don't get. And we end up having conversations where I say, okay, so Tor encrypts here and encrypts here and encrypts here and it doesn't encrypt there. Get it? And their answer is, well, wait a minute, you're telling me that Tor encrypts my traffic and you're telling me that Tor doesn't encrypt my traffic. Pick one, you idiot. And so then we have to go back and say, well, let me teach you about overlay networks, and let me tell you about internet links. And so part of our challenge is to figure out how to phrase this for the millions of people out there. Tor was easy to use. Everybody got it right for the first probably 10,000 users. And then the next couple of million users were ordinary internet people. Okay, so far so good? So there are a bunch of different things that we spend our time on. One of them lately, we've been working on performance and scalability. How do we handle the next 500,000 people? How do we load balance better over the relays that we have? What happens if we get another 10,000 relays? How do we give the network information to the users in a way that they can have the same view of the network as everybody else? Another thing we work on, at the beginning we said, here is Tor. It's a SOX proxy. If you use it correctly, you'll be safe. And then people started using Firefox with Tor, and then people started using Internet Explorer with Tor, and you go to a website and they overflow your website and take over your computer, and then they blame Tor for the fact that they were running insecure software that Microsoft gave them. So our next approach was to say, okay, so this is the browser you should use. Here's a Firefox extension that will keep you safe at the application level. Here's the HTTP proxy you should use. Don't ever use that other program. And then we fell down the slippery slope of maintaining every application out there. So at this point, there's a Firefox extension that we have called Tor Button that basically rewrites big parts of Firefox in order to keep you safe. And every time Mozilla comes out with a new version of Firefox, we rewrite big parts of it on the inside to be able to make sure it doesn't leak your cookies or your history or fall victim to CSS attacks or cross-site anything and all sorts of stuff that we should do a separate session on. So we're maintaining more and more of the software on the internet as we go, which is not really sustainable, but who else is going to do it? Blocking resistance, circumvention. So Tor provides pretty good anonymity if you can reach the Tor network. But if you're in China and they grab the list of Tor relays and they block them all, then who cares how good Tor is? You can't reach it. So that's something we've been working on over the past couple of years, and we should work a lot more on soon because a lot remains. And then reusability, modularity. Tor is an overlay network. We'll get to this in a few more slides. Tor is an overlay network that lets you build a path given a set of relays. So there are a bunch of different ways you could learn about the relays, and I don't really want to care how you learn about the relays, but given the set of relays, it will build the path for you, do the encryption, do the flow control, all of that. And then, yeah, we'll get into all this later. Okay, so talk number three, the whole circumvention side of things. There are really two pieces to all of these circumvention tools out there. There's the relay component and the discovery component. Tor has focused mostly on the relay component, which is, given a set of relays, how do I build the path through them in a way that I get the encryption right, in a way I can do the flow control correctly? And then the discovery component is, how do I learn what those relays are? Before Tor entered the circumvention space, most circumvention tools were entirely about the discovery component, because for them, the relay component was, it's a proxy. That's the only possible option. It's a proxy. How do I get you the proxy address? That was the question they were all asking. And Tor showed up saying, here is this really cool distributed trust proxy design, and now how do I get you the address? So the discovery component is the same in both cases. So the way that Tor does discovery as of a few years ago, and this is still the way that it does it for most users, there is a centralized directory design. There are 8 directory authorities run by people like me. They're around the world. And all the relays build server descriptors over here that are self-signed that say, here's my address, here are my keys, here are my exit policies. And they publish those to the directory authorities, which produce a consensus of what the network looks like at this hour. And then they all sign it. And then the Tor clients fetch it from somewhere. They can check the signatures. They know they've got the same view of the network as everybody else because it's signed by the directory authorities and it's got a timestamp on it. So that works great, except in the case of the censorship situation where there is a big list of all the relays and all you have to do is block it. So the first approach for blocking Tor, you take those 8 hard-coded IP addresses and you block them. Really took censors a long time before they did that. I think nobody's actually taken that approach yet. The second approach is you block all the 2,000. I'm going to move this thing out of the way so it doesn't distract all of you. So the second approach is you get that network status and you block all the 2,000 IP addresses in it. And China did that last year, but it took them many years before they got around to doing that. The third approach is you look at the fingerprint on the wire and you can say it tries to look like SSL. That person's trying to look like a web browser talking to a web server, but I can tell it's Tor because of the way it does this over here, so I'm going to hang up on that connection and block Tor based on what I see on the network. And then the fourth approach is you block the website, so they can't get to torproject.org, and then they don't even try anymore. There are a lot of users out there in Thailand and China and other places who are saying, Tor was pretty cool, but now I can't get to the website, so obviously the tool doesn't work. And the tool does work, but they are just so used to thinking of websites equal circumvention tool that if the website goes away, they figure it doesn't work anymore. Thailand is an interesting case here because we were getting mail from them probably 4 years ago saying torproject.org is blocked in Thailand. I live in a democracy. I'm going to sue. It's against the law for them to block these things. And then a year or two later, the tanks roll, and it turns out maybe they don't live in a democracy. So one of the interesting things about internet censorship is that we get mail from countries who are currently democracies, but maybe they won't be soon. From people who are thinking about censoring their internet. So I'm not sure what lesson we should draw from that about what to expect about the Australian government in a couple of years or the British government in a couple of years. We'll find out. Give it a few years. Okay, so the defense that we have against this whole what if you block this list of IP addresses is what we call bridge relays. So we've got these 500,000 users over here, and we let them turn into relays that are not published in the public list, but they're unpublished or hidden or private bridge relays. And so we've changed the problem from how do we take these 2,000 public IP addresses and give them to every Tor user without letting China learn them, which is an impossible problem, to how do we take these 5,000 or 10,000 or 50,000 bridge addresses and give them out one at a time to the good guys without letting the bad guys learn all of them. And that's still a hard arms race, but it's at least a little bit better than the first one. So, yeah, the bridges don't have to transit very much traffic. They don't have to exit to the rest of the internet, so they don't have to worry about angry websites wondering why they sent them abuse mail or something. You're just bridging from the person in whatever country it is to you to the Tor network. Okay, so how has this actually worked in practice, this whole Tor thing? Here's a graph. A very rough graph of the number of people connecting from Iran into the Tor network last June during the whole election thing. So here is when everything started, and it spiked up to something like 8,000 people a day connecting through Tor, and then it fell off a little bit. So I was actually talking to the chief security officer of Facebook a couple of years ago who was data mining their logs because they wanted to know where their users are coming from during this experience. So Facebook, before June of 2009, hated Tor because they're all about, I've got users, I need to advertise to them, I need to know exactly who my users are, and Tor makes this harder, so I hate anonymizers. And then suddenly, Facebook got blocked in Iran and China, and all of their users started to use anonymizers and circumventions and so on to get to Facebook. And then Facebook started saying, I love Tor. Tor's great. Tor lets my users reach my website. So they really did a switch at that point. So they were looking at their weblogs thinking, how many users are coming from Tor? How many users are coming from other places? And their answer was, they saw 10,000 people a day coming through Tor into Facebook, into the Iranian social network. So I'm guessing that these numbers are extremely conservative relative to what we actually saw. But at the same time, I put China up here because, first of all the Western press I could find last June was saying Iran, 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 and nobody was saying China. So, in fact, there were several times more people using Tor in China. Here is the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. They call it May 35th because they're not allowed to say June 4 on their internet. So there were a lot of people there who were wondering on that day, what is this May 35th thing? What really happened there. So there were a lot more people using Tor. But over here is where China blocked Google Search, Google Groups, Google Calendar, Google something else. So there were a lot more people at that point saying, wait a minute, I thought my government was keeping me safe on the internet, but they blocked Google. That's censorship. That's a bad country. So there were a lot more people who were realizing that they needed a way around the firewall at that point. And part of China's challenge here is that they block Google for a little while, A lot of people get angry. A lot of people learn how to circumvent the firewall. And then they have to stop blocking it because too many people are angry. So it goes back to the sort of the antibiotic approach, where if you only take the first third of your penicillin, then the bugs in you learn how to defend themselves against penicillin better later. So China is sort of walking its citizens through learning how to get around the firewall, where they block Google, they make a lot of people angry, a lot of people learn how to get around the firewall, then they back off, and then later they do it again. So there are millions of people in China who are learning all sorts of ways around the firewall just in case they need them next time. So that was the good news. Here's the not so good news. Here is the number of people connecting from China IP addresses into one of the relays last September. So October 1 was the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of some guy becoming in charge in China. And for the week leading up to it, they worked really hard to block all sorts of proxies and everything that they could work on blocking. So they also blocked Tor. I mean, it's easy. There are 2,000 IP addresses. You get them, you block them, you're done. So the good news here, here's the drop-off, and these are the number of people using bridges to connect from China into the Tor network. So basically 30,000 people switched in the course of a week or so. I guess it was a little bit longer to reach the 30,000 point, but a lot of people learned about bridges and switched. So this is great news. We researched how they would attack us. We figured out that they'd probably block it like this. We deployed the bridge design. We translated it into Chinese and other languages, and we had documentation and easy-to-use tools ready for that week before the week arrived. And at that point, a whole lot of people switched seamlessly from connecting directly to using bridges, which is pretty cool, but there's some more to it. So how do you find the bridges? There are three ways of doing it. One of them is you go to https://bridges.torproject.org, and depending on where on the internet you're coming from, it gives you a different answer. So that means you can always get a few bridges, but if you want to learn all of them, you have to come from a lot of different places around the internet. China broke that the same day they did this. So China learned all the bridges that we gave out through HTTPS on that same day. The second approach, there's a different set of bridges that we give out through Gmail. So you email us at bridges@torproject.org from your Gmail account, and we send you a few answers. And if you want to learn all of them, you have to make a few thousand Gmail accounts. And so the goal there is Google is already fighting its own arms race with spammers and phishers and so on. So why don't we let Google take care of making it hard to make a lot of Google accounts? So that worked pretty well. China did not break that on that particular day. And then the third approach, so it took them, we'll see in a few more slides, it took them until this March to break the Gmail approach. So the third approach is through informal social networks. On that September 25th day when everything went bad, there were 40 bridges that we hadn't given out to anybody. And I found a friend of mine in Shanghai and said, here are 40 bridges, do something smart with them. So he set up a password-protected Twitter account, signed up his 1,200 closest friends, and tweeted a few bridges every hour. And those bridges had a lot of people using them. So that's part of why we ended up being able to have so many people using bridges over time, because a lot of these people were using bridges that had been given out through social network approaches. We are starting to see people using bridges in a way where they don't send them to our central repository, so we never even know about them. There's a little button you can press when you're setting up your bridge that says, I'm going to publish this one myself. So you know somebody in China or you're part of a nonprofit or something, so you set up a bridge and you hand them the address, and Tor is never in the picture, which seems to be more and more the approach that people should use. So the big picture is one working bridge is enough. Because we have local software running on your computer, that means that if you can set up 10 bridges, then as long as one of them is still reachable, you can follow where the other 9 went if they're on dynamic IP addresses or something like that. So all of this should happen in an automated way on your local Tor client, which means you need to bootstrap at the beginning, but once you're bootstrapped, it should all take care of it for you. So far, so good? Okay, so another problem that I'm not going to talk about today is hiding Tor's network fingerprint. So once upon a time, Tor used two protocols on the wire. One of them was SSL to actually do the encryption, And the other one was HTTP to do the directory fetches. And that seemed reasonable. I mean, we're doing directory fetches, so we should use HTTP. There's an American company called SmartFilter and another American company called WebSense that noticed that if you see a web request that starts with /tor/, they should kill it, and then Tor will stop working. So this is what happened back in 2007. And WebSense was, I think, the people who built the firewall for Syria, and SmartFilter was operating the firewall for Iran. So this meant that Tor stopped working in a lot of Middle Eastern countries. That was actually what got us motivated to this whole circumvention censorship thing. So the fix for that was we now tunnel the directory requests inside the SSL connection, so it all looks encrypted, and now it's a lot harder to recognize that it's Tor. So the fun story about that, at the beginning of 2009, Iran said, we're going to build our own firewall. We don't need those Western devils. We're going to stop using SmartFilter. We're going to build our own system. And that meant that they stopped filtering the old version of Tor, which was years out of date, that we'd pretty much forgotten about. And then when the whole election thing happened in June, about half of the people who were using Tor to connect to the Tor network from Iran were using the version of Tor that was years out of date and had not worked for a couple of years in Iran. So the lesson there is these people installed Tor years before, tried it out and said, okay, that's interesting, or man, I don't know how that works, or boy, that's slow, or whatever they were saying, and then they stopped. And then 2 years passed, and then somebody said, you can get to Facebook if you use Tor. And they're like, hey, I already have that. I'm going to click it and see how it goes. So there are a lot of people out there who have tried Tor and have it on their computer, and they're ready for this sort of day, whether it's Vietnam or Iran or Sweden or I'm not sure. Okay, so looking at things differently, what sort of goals does the attacker have here in terms of censorship? There are two main categories of information that they're trying to suppress. The first category is stuff that embarrasses them, human rights violations, corruption, stuff that they really don't want the rest of the world to see. And then the second category is actual opposition information. I'm trying to organize a protest. Let's all meet at the street corner at midnight tonight with our pitchforks, that sort of thing that they really want to prevent people from learning about. And they don't have to block everything. It's all about giving people the impression that they're censored, so people end up self-censoring. People say, I bet that they're going to notice that and prevent me from publishing it or reading it, so I'm not even going to try. I'm not even going to try to go to that website. Another important point, they don't go after you if you read the wrong thing. I talk to a lot of computer scientists who say, here's how I'm going to beat Tor in China. Imagine I'm China. I'm going to go find 5 Tor users, and I'm going to publicly execute them. And I'm going to repeat until there are no more Tor users. And they're very satisfied with their algorithm. But I tell this to people in China, and they just laugh, because China walks a much finer line than that. They can't afford to publicly kill everybody repeatedly. That would make even more people upset. The reason why China is in power right now is because some of its citizens are saying, I just bought a third television. This isn't so bad. So as long as they're pretty happy in their situation and they don't mind the government too much, then China is going to stay in charge. But they can't just go round people up and kill them because they're using the internet. There are millions of people there who are using the internet. So they have to really do a good balancing act between keeping people from speaking out too much and still letting them speak out some. So the first lesson here from talking to people in these various countries, they're not going to mess with you if you read the wrong page. If you accidentally get to Wikipedia and you read the article on democracy, they're not going to kick down your door and say, you have information you weren't supposed to learn. If you wrote the Wikipedia page on democracy, that's a different story. Then they get upset at you. And there are a lot fewer people out there who are producing this information than are consuming it. And then another thing to look at, all these countries have incentives not to just censor the whole internet. When I first was starting out on this problem, I was thinking, okay, if I make China turn off the internet, did I win or did I lose? Because I don't want China to turn off the internet. And the answer is they're not going to. It doesn't matter. There are too many incentives, too many reasons inside their country why they will not just turn off the thing. And this is different from Burma, for example, where they said, step zero of our coup is let's turn off the internet. And they basically haven't turned it on since. So it really depends which country you're looking at. Another fun example there is India, where a few years ago, somebody in Pakistan did a blog post about some religious thing, and India said, we're going to have a war on our hands if our citizens read that, so please filter that blog post. So they sent mail to the 7 top ISPs in India and said, there is a URL, and I would like you to censor it. And the URL was a little website that they hadn't really heard of called blogspot.com. So for about a week, the top 7 ISPs in India filtered all of Blogspot. And this got a lot of people in India really angry, because you'll recognize this phrase from before. We were hearing from a lot of people in India saying, I live in a democracy. They can't do this. I'm going to sue. And yet they did it. So just depends what collateral damage they're willing to take. So how does the censorship actually work? There are a bunch of different approaches. Pretty much everywhere, blocks by IP address or port at the firewall. That's a very common one. Another one that happens in various countries, you intercept DNS requests. For example, YouTube.com in Turkey points you to another page that says in Turkish a very short note saying you really don't want to be looking at this page. Apparently there's some dude named Ataturk that somebody made fun of on YouTube, and now nobody in Turkey can see anything on YouTube. And then China has another approach where they look at every TCP packet going back and forth, and if they find a word like Falun that they don't want you talking about, then they just kill the whole TCP stream. And Iran has these fancy boxes that they bought from Nokia where they get to do deep packet inspection, and they can actually figure out which traffic flows are using SSL. Even if you're not using port 443, they can still recognize this is SSL. And then they can throttle it. They can rate limit the SSL traffic. And then Russia has another approach where Russia filters some stuff, but really not very much. They don't actually censor much. But if you do a blog post and you say, I think what's wrong with my country is X, then 20 other people will show up on the same blog and say, I think what's wrong with my country is Y. No, I think it's Z. And then 5 more people will show up and say, X is great, I love Russia because of X. And then somebody else will say, I love Russia because of Y. And then you've got 50 people all shilling for the government in one way or another. And it's a lot harder to figure out what your fellow citizens actually think. In China, they call these people the 50-cent party. You get paid 0.5 currency units for every pro-China blog post you make. So there are people who make spare money on the side talking about how great China is on the internet. Okay, so what are we up against? Once upon a time in China, the firewall was stateless. And by that I mean it can't remember about the flows going back and forth. It just has to look at every byte as it's going by, and if that at every packet as it's going by. And if that packet convinces the firewall that that flow is evil, then it hangs up on you. And if the packet can get by, then you're all set. So there's a cute circumvention trick in China where you break your sensitive words into 2 different TCP packets, and then they both get through. Because one of them says fal, and the other one says un, and then nobody realizes you're talking about the Falun Gong. So that sort of works. But there are different approaches here. China has so much traffic going back and forth that they can't afford to look at each traffic flow very carefully. Whereas Burma doesn't have very much traffic. They can watch everything as carefully as they want to. And if they want to buy new hardware, so I think Fortinet built the Burmese firewall originally, and then Cisco underbid them, so now Cisco operates the Burmese firewall. But, I mean, there's a lot of hardware you can put there, and you can look very carefully at all the traffic flows. And then Iran is somewhere in between. I think Arbor Networks has this great graph of network connectivity in Iran last year, where in June it basically goes to zero, and then they turn it on 1 gigabit at a time. So there's this step function in the graph, which is Iran figures out how to do censorship and surveillance on 1 more gigabit, so they turn that back on. And then they figure out how to do it for 1 more, and so on. So it's really pretty scary that they only allow the number of bytes to go through that they feel comfortable censoring and surveilling. So that's sort of a different approach than China. So the fundamental problem here is these are all American corporations that are selling this stuff and operating it. When I started out this problem, I was thinking, okay, it's me against China. I can handle this. But it's not me against China. It's me against 1,000 PhDs at Cisco who are trying to build software to help Boeing censor its employees on the internet. So the problem, if we want to look at it this way, how can I make it so that Boeing ends up happy, So its employees can't read about porn or democracy or whatever at work. But the product that Boeing is buying doesn't make Iran happy. How can we separate the arms race so the companies that these companies are selling their hardware to are happy, but the authoritarian regimes who profit from buying and using the same stuff don't find that it works for them? I don't have a good answer for how to do that. I was in Australia a little while ago explaining this dilemma to Whit Diffie, who's a security crypto guy, and he was saying, oh, it's easy. You just make a list of all the bad corporations who are willing to sell to governments that kill their citizens, and you make a list of all the good corporations who aren't willing to sell their hardware to these countries, and then you then you publicize who's in which list. The problem is there is nobody in that second list. That second list is empty. There are no hardware vendors who are not pleased to sell their hardware to any country around the world, no matter what that country is going to do with it. So I'm not sure how to solve that one either. Okay, other messy things. I'm only going to talk about this one very briefly. Application level worries. So Tor hides where your traffic is going to or where it's coming from, but what you say, we can't solve. So the intuitive version of this is, I'm going to do a blog post over Tor, and I'm going to write my name on the blog post. Tor doesn't keep me safe. Why not? It's because I put my name on the blog post. Tor hides the traffic where it goes. It doesn't fix the fact that what you're sending might identify you. And there are a lot of application-level things that your web browser sends about you that identify you really well, even though you don't even know your browser is sending them. So every time I go anywhere in Internet Explorer, it says, these are the versions of Internet Explorer I've got. These are the versions of which fonts I have. My browser window is this many pixels by this many pixels. I prefer Swedish, but if you can't do Swedish, English is okay. And German's pretty good as a third option. All of these are the sorts of things that can let websites recognize you as you come back. I don't know who that guy was, but he's the one who prefers Swedish, else English, else German, and has a browser window that's like this. So we give you a Firefox extension called Tor Button that tries to keep you safe against some of these, but it gets worse. So Flash is, you go to a website, the website hands you an arbitrary binary, you execute the arbitrary binary, and we're somehow supposed to keep you safe anyway? So the answer for Tor Button right now is we turn off Flash. No plugins for you. And this is not a great solution because you're in Turkey, you can't get to YouTube, you download Tor so you can get to YouTube, you go to YouTube, and Tor keeps you safe by keeping you from reading your Flash videos. That's not good. HTML5 might solve this, but nobody's ever going to actually move to it. It's worse than that. So Microsoft Word. I download a doc file over Tor. I do it very safely. I get it. Nobody knows where I got the doc file from. Then I click it. It has an image link embedded in it with a bunch of backslashes. That turns it into a NetBIOS call that bypasses my proxy and goes directly to whatever website the guy who sent me the doc file wants me to go to. So I need to somehow set a proxy in my Microsoft Word. It doesn't support that. So I guess one lesson there is if you're on Windows, you're screwed, except most of our users are on Windows. So I guess the lesson is that most of our users are screwed. We need to come up with some way at the application level that's actually going to keep people safe. So there are a bunch of different installers out there that might help. The first approach is the Tor browser bundle for Windows, where we give you Firefox, Tor, Tor Button, everything pre-configured, no plugins for you. And if you can use it, then it will keep you safe. And if it doesn't do what you want to do, then we didn't know how to give that to you in a way that's both usable and would keep you safe. So a lot of people now are using the Tor browser bundle. It's a single blob that you can put on a USB key and carry around with you. There's the Tor VM that we haven't gotten very far on. It's more like a Tor network card, really. The idea is that you boot inside QEMU a Tor client and a Linux kernel and some IP tables rules, and it becomes your network. So every connection that goes out of Windows goes into this QEMU that then either gets put through Tor or dropped on the floor. And that means that if you click on your doc file, it will fail to load the image, or that image fetch will go over Tor. It's not perfect because you could still send your name or your IP address or your sensitive business documents or whatever if somebody breaks into your Flash application and controls your computer, but it's at least better. And then the live CD approach is another good one, where we give you an Ubuntu system that has everything pre-configured, and all of its traffic gets sent through Tor. So hopefully that would make you safer. But again, you need to learn how to boot onto a CD, which if you care enough, maybe you'll learn how to do, but there are a lot of people who don't care quite that much. Okay, so Tor is only a piece of the puzzle. There are a lot of people out there who say, I got Tor, so I'm totally safe. I don't need to do anything more. And you need to learn all about internet security, and there are other things that Tor is not going to solve for you. For example, if you're using the village's Windows 98 computer, and it is full of spyware, and it has a hardware keylogger, and there's somebody standing behind you watching your screen, Tor is not going to solve this situation. Beijing has a rule that came into effect last year where you need to have a video camera watching the screen of every user in every internet cafe, and Tor is not going to solve that. I'm told by people in China that the first person who walks in that morning reaches up and turns the camera away, and nobody ever turns it back. So it's not that bad, but it's still an example of a situation that we're not going to solve. Another challenging one, I was doing a talk for a bunch of activists from an East Asian communist country that's not China a little while ago. And I was all set to teach them about information security, 40-bit encryption bad, 128-bit encryption good, use Firefox, not IE, maybe you should stop using Windows, let me tell you about Tor and PGP and OTR and full disk encryption. And they were getting phone calls in the audience saying, so-and-so just got arrested, what should we do? And it quickly became clear that no information security I'm going to teach them is going to help them with their operational security, which is really what the problem was. Once you've been identified by the Vietnamese Secret Service, my software is not going to help you. They're going to be following you around. And they were telling me horrible stories, like I go to the bathroom and they break into my house and answer my Skype calls. So I use encrypted Skype, but I still have to ask a question that the person on the other end sometimes doesn't know the answer to. Or there's a fellow across the street with a parabolic microphone listening to everything I say. So I use encrypted Skype, but they still hear everything I say. So one of the fun stories that we finally solved a few months ago, they had laptops that they were using, and they were pretty sure that they kept the laptop safe the whole time. But something like 6 months ago, there were seven central dissidents, and one of them sent PGP encrypted mail to the other six, and that mail got published in the national newspaper the next day. And everybody's like, is PGP broken? Did they get spyware on the computers? Are one of these seven people a mole? How did they do this? And we finally found out the answer. It turns out that Microsoft Windows does not ship with Vietnamese support by default. And this means that if you want your computer to be in Vietnamese, you go get the Vietnamese keyboard driver from the recommended website, which has been backdoored by the Vietnamese Secret Service. So every single person running Microsoft Windows with Vietnamese support is part of the Vietnamese Secret Service botnet. That's par for the course in internet security. But that's another situation where Tor is not going to help you. So it gets even worse. What happens if China mirrors the Tor website? They block it right now. Torproject.org doesn't work. What happens if they make a copy of the website and then they redirect all DNS requests inside China to their copy and they do a different version of the Tor binary? The only thing I'm going to notice is happy users sending me mail saying, hey, Roger, Tor works again. I'm using it. It's great. I'm all set. Except they're actually using Yellow Dog Tor, not the version of Tor that I want them to use. So one answer is PGP. If you've met me and you've got my business card and you know what PGP is, you can check the signature on the Tor tarball or package that you get. That works pretty well for people in the U.S. and Europe. I've met, 50,000 people. They can check my key. Everybody knows that I'm me. That works pretty poorly in Iran or China or other places where most people there haven't met me and don't know how to check keys and so on. Publicity attracts attention. A lot of circumvention tools start by going to the Washington Post or the New York Times or the whatever the London Times is called and saying, we're going to take out China, democracy. We're going to give them all democracy. So there's a front page article saying such and such new product is going to beat China. And their web page gets blocked before they've written the first line of code. And that's because China reads these newspaper articles and they say, this is embarrassing to us, we have to solve it. So there are really two categories of things that China blocks. The first category is stuff that works really well. If you've got a million users and they're all happy, then they have to block that because there are too many people who are getting around the firewall. And the second category are people who are loud, people who are embarrassing. So even if your tool doesn't work, the more the world thinks it works, the more they have to block it. So the other way of looking at that is we can control the pace of the arms race. As long as we don't say, hey, China, look what we're doing, then they can not actually look at us and everybody's happy. The goal of the firewall is not to prevent everybody from getting through. They let SSH through. There are entire protocols that just work out of the box. So it's all about giving people the impression that they remember who's in charge. So part of my challenge from a journalism perspective, every time I do a talk like this, there's some journalist in the audience who came to my talk with the goal of writing Tor Project Declares War on China as their headline. And I mean, these are great headlines. They sell newspapers. Lone American Hacker Conquers Communist Nation. This is what people like to read, so it's what people try to write. But the challenge from the journalism side is the only people who read those articles are people in the West, and the people who choose the policy for the firewalls. Nobody else in China is going to read that, so it hurts us. So if you're one of those journalists, I'd love to chat with you afterwards, and we can talk about civil liberties and all sorts of other great uses of Tor, and maybe we can leave China out of the first two paragraphs of your article. Using Tor in oppressed areas. So I talk to a lot of people who say, well, sure, Tor works now in these countries, but once they start cracking down more and more, it's going to be illegal to use Tor in these countries. I actually think it's going to be the opposite. So imagine a firewall that adds more and more things to what it censors. So as it adds more and more things, the set of things that it's censoring is more and more ordinary. So you're adding Tor users every time you censor more things, but you're not adding Tor dissidents. You're not adding people who want to change your government. You're adding people who say, I could read my pictures of kittens yesterday, and today I can't see my pictures of kittens, so now I have this tool that lets me read my webcomics. I'm not an activist, I'm not a dissident, I just want to read the internet. So as you crack down more and more on the internet, the average Tor user is going to be somebody who wants to see their kitten pictures. It's not going to be a dissident. So that's part of why Tor is safe to use in a lot of these countries. There are 100,000 people all using Tor, almost all of them using it to read the webcomics that you filtered by accident. And that means that if you find a user of Tor, you shouldn't put him in jail. He's not an activist. He's just somebody who's reading something that you shouldn't have censored, but you did anyway. Okay, another fun thing. A couple of years ago, there was a researcher at the Berkman Center at Harvard who found a frequently asked questions list for one of these products. And the question was, do you sell user data? And the answer was, yes. And the more you pay, the better the data is. And a lot of their users freaked out because I'm using you as a circumvention tool. Surely you're keeping me safe, right? But the answer was, no, we're a circumvention tool. We let you reach Facebook. What does that have to do with privacy? Of course we log everything our users do. Of course we sell it. And I'm not sure if I'm more upset by that or the follow-up statement, which was, of course we answer every request from law enforcement. What's a subpoena? I don't understand what you're so upset about. So part of the challenge here is there are a lot of organizations out there, a lot of tools, a lot of proxies that think of privacy and circumvention as completely independent things. And part of Tor's goal is to make them exactly the same thing. If you are circumventing the firewall in Iran by using a plaintext proxy and you end up in jail a week later, then maybe you should have used a proxy that gave you more safety, security, anonymity, privacy. So there are a lot of situations where right now you don't understand how bad your threat model is, but if you had had protection today, you would not be in jail next week. Australia has been rolling out internet censorship. I think Sweden's been working on internet censorship. I think England already does it. Denmark does it. So part of the challenge here is that when policy people from the State Department and other governments go to China and say, you are doing a bad thing by censoring your citizens, China very reasonably says, Australia censors its internet. England censors its internet. Belgium, Denmark, Canada's looking at it. Why are you picking on me? We're just keeping our citizens safe, just like everybody else does. So I guess one lesson here is we have to go to countries like Australia and Sweden and make them end up with good policy. Because if we can't fix democracies, how are we going to fix countries like China? How do we figure out if the bridges are blocked? One easy answer is I get a shell account in China and I scan all the bridges. That sounds great until they recognize that that's where I'm scanning all the bridges from, and then they just watch what I scan and block all of those. So the other answer is the bridges passively look at how many connections they get. So if I have 800 connections from China today and I have no connections from China tomorrow, I bet that means I've been blocked. In practice, we only have 500 bridges right now, which is not good enough. And we don't have that many people successfully using any given bridge, which means the numbers are not 800 down to zero. The numbers are 10 down to 5. And did 5 people go to sleep? Is it just being used a little bit less? Did it get blocked? It's hard for us to tell. So the result of that is that we end up giving out bridges that are probably not going to work for you, but we don't know whether they're going to work. The other side of that is, what sort of better strategies are there for giving out bridges that force the attacker to exercise some scarce resource that maybe you have to SMS us, spend a phone number, be well connected in a social network, play this game 3 times so that you end up getting a high score? What sort of cute tricks are there where China is bad at doing them in mass, but individuals are pretty good at doing them a few times? Advocacy and education. There are an unending stream of people in Washington, D.C. who do not understand the internet, but they are making critical policy decisions. So part of my side hobby is to go teach law enforcement and staffers in Congress and other people what this internet thing is and what this Tor thing is and why you might want to be safe on the internet. And one of the challenges there is there's a high churn rate. As soon as I teach one of them and they figure it out and they understand the internet, they go get a different job. So I end up with completely new people every time, and I have to go teach them about internet security, and they've got better things to do. And that's how we end up with crazy laws like data retention, and you need a driver's license for the internet, and other things that involve, let's write down every bit of personal information about every citizen, we'll store it in a database, and we'll keep it really secure, but we'll let everybody access it. That's never going to work. But that's a separate talk. Okay, so next steps. Technical solutions are not going to solve the whole thing. There are a lot of people in China and Iran and Vietnam and other places who are saying, I'm so glad my government keeps me safe on the internet. And as long as most people in these countries are saying this, no tool that I build is going to change their country or let them change their country. On the other hand, there are a lot of technical people in all these countries who really want to do things and be safer about it on the internet. When I was starting this out, I was thinking, I have to make this thing perfect, because if it's not perfect, people are going to die, and it's going to be my fault. But then I started actually talking to activists, and they're using nothing if I don't give them anything. They're just plain text connection. I hope they don't put me in jail. So if I give them Tor, they're less likely to go into jail, and it's a significant improvement compared to what was there before. So you should all run bridges or relays. I hear Sweden has pretty good connectivity. We heard that in the keynote earlier today. So there's a fellow down here wearing a green Tor t-shirt named Linus who speaks Swedish and lives in Stockholm and would be pleased to talk to you more about how you can help to save the world. If you know anybody around the world who needs trainings, first of all, people in policy land in Sweden who are making bad decisions or good decisions and should learn more about internet and censorship and privacy and Tor and what that means for the internet, then we'd love to help do some more trainings. Okay, and then the last talk, we've got data. We're getting a bit of funding from the U.S. organization called the National Science Foundation, and they fund basic research. One of the research questions we've got is, how can we collect summary statistics about users in a way that we can tell general trends of Tor usage both performance of the network and scalability of the network and where the users are coming from in a way that doesn't hurt all of them. So here are a few graphs to give you a sample of what sort of things we've got. Here we've got the number of people connecting from China to the public Tor relays. So we've got a building set, and then at the beginning of October, they block them all. And then I changed one of the 8 IP addresses for the directory authorities. I said, hey, let's do an experiment. Let's change one. Maybe China won't ever notice. And it was 3 months or something before they noticed that all the Tor users were working again. So one of the neat things about how China does its blocking, it's not cat and mouse. It's not I put something up, they block it. I put something up, they block it. China has 3 or 4 events every year, political events, right before the Congress in March or 60th anniversary last September. December 25th, they beheaded some British journalist, and they didn't want the rest of the world to have a lot of press right then. So they have particular political events. And during that event, they do a lot of blocking. And other than those events, they totally ignore it. So Tor basically doesn't work directly. Here we have connections from Iran into Tor, into the public relays. And over here is when we fixed our, I've got one of these. Over here is when we fixed our GeoIP database to be more accurate about which IP addresses are from Iran. So you should actually imagine that this line goes all the way across with 10,000, 15,000 people connecting every day from Iran. Another interesting part is this right here. There was a week in October where Tor did not work in Iran. And my theory for that is they had that knob that allows them to turn down SSL. So periodically, when they get freaked out that their citizens are going to riot too much, they turn down the knob, so they turn off Gmail. They turn off other things that you would use SSL to connect to. And because Tor said, let's look like SSL, nobody would ever block SSL, they blocked us for a week. So part of what we need to do is have a more adaptable transport so we can look like Skype or SSL or nothing at all. And that way it'll be easier for us to get around whatever blocking they decide to do. And here we have connections from China to bridges where nobody cared at all for this time, and then suddenly we had a lot of people. And then this is where they blocked the Gmail approach. So there were a lot of people using bridges that they'd learned through Gmail. China learned the bridges that you can learn through Gmail and blocked them. It didn't block everybody because there were a lot of people using bridges that had been given out through social networks. And then that recovered where we gave it a lot more that way, and then they basically are kicking our ass at the arms race right now. And the reason for that is that we've got 500 bridges, and we need to reevaluate what our strategy is. I was first thinking, we need a whole lot of bridges so that China can't block them all. But what I should have been saying was, we need the rate of new bridges that we get to be higher than the rate that China blocks bridges. So it's not about the total number of bridges, it's about the churn, it's about the new IP addresses that we get. So now we're working on some other strategies that don't involve having a couple of bridges here and here and here, but rather having corporations and universities redirect /16s into the Tor network, and then you rotate what parts of that address space go in. One of the neat things about China is that they are very precise about what they block. A lot of the computer scientists I talk to say, well, sure, if you start with this big network and you use 5 of the addresses, they're going to block the whole rest of the address space, right? I mean, wouldn't you do that if you were an attacker? But actually, they unblock it as soon as you take the proxy away. So they make sure that they're blocking exactly the pieces of the address space that have the proxies right then, and they never block anything else. So here are users connecting to using bridges from Iran. And the answer is basically none of them. So on the one hand, that's reasonable, because you don't need a bridge to use Tor in Iran. But on the other hand, bridges are a security feature that we probably haven't made as much use of as we should. In particular, imagine your attacker is smart, and they don't just block Tor. They get the list of 2,000 IP addresses, and they look at who connects to them. So now they can enumerate the Tor users in their country. They don't block them. They just make a list. If you were using a bridge, then you would not be in their list because you'd be connecting to an IP address that's not associated with Tor. So maybe there are security reasons, not just reachability reasons, to have bridges. Nobody uses Tor in South Korea on weekends. That's a different talk. How many relays have we had over time? So we've got a bunch of people growing. At the end of each year, I do a talk in Berlin that gets a bunch of people excited. Here was the Iran election, where we had a lot of people adding new relays and some people adding new bridges. And then the Windows people got distracted and stopped running them, and there were quite a few Linux people who kept their relays up. Here is when some researcher at the University of Massachusetts signed up all of Planet Lab as exit relays. He signed up 500 Planet Lab nodes in one day, and we noticed them pretty quickly and cut them out, but there's a separate lesson there about if you're planning on experimenting on the Live Tor network, please tell us, and we can help you do your experiment in a way that will actually get you the results you want. And Tor has been slow over time. So this was when we started looking at performance a little while ago. So this is fetching a 50 kilobyte file over Tor over and over. And back then, it took about 7.5 seconds to fetch your file. And then we added a performance fix that brought it down to about 4 seconds. In April, all hell broke loose. There were a couple of bugs that were starting to crash the fast Tor relays. And then here, we rolled out a performance fix that prioritizes circuits that haven't sent very much lately. So that means that if you're doing BitTorrent, you slow down a bit, and if you're doing web browsing, you speed up a lot. At the same time, China blocked a lot of the network, which means that 100,000 users disappeared. And at the same time, there were a lot of volunteers who showed up with new relays, so the capacity of the network doubled. So here's another way of looking at that performance. The red line is the performance you got a year ago, where the median download was 7.5 seconds. And the new one this year is around the 3-second mark. So Tor is really fast right now. And does that mean that we're all set, everybody's happy? Does that mean we should get more users to make it slow again? I'm not sure what the right balance is. And I have, 5 minutes left? Okay, and I've got 5 minutes left for questions, and I'll be walking around in a bright green Tor t-shirt for today and tomorrow, so I should be easy to spot. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, since I'm the moderator, I can start with one question while you are heading a microphone to the end of the room. And that is, now and then I come across people that argue that Tor only is a mean for pedophiles to hide their porn child material. So what is the reply to that?
There are a couple of answers to that. The first answer is, we've got hundreds of thousands of users, and almost all of them are ordinary people. The second answer is, there's an organization in England called the Internet Watch Foundation. They're the people who are supposed to design the filter list for England. They sent me mail a couple of months ago asking a question that was not in the top 10 list of questions I would expect them to ask. Their question was, how do I make Tor faster? And it turns out that the people in England who are supposed to be building the sensor lists use Tor in order to see the internet in the way that everybody else does. So a lot of people, there's another group at the FBI called the Innocent Images Unit. They're the equivalent in U.S. law enforcement who are supposed to track down child porn people. They use Tor every day for their job. So the first answer is law enforcement actually needs tools like Tor in order to do their job. And the second answer is bad guys have lots of options. They don't need Tor.
Okay, good. Thank
you. So I will ask your question again, but replace Tor with internet. I hear there are bad people on the internet. What do you have to say about that? Once, for the first 10,000 users, they were all security geeks. The next 500,000 users were an ordinary cross-section of the internet.
Very good, thank you. So could you please say your name and...
Hi, my name is Ulrika Engström. I used to live in China for quite a long time, so I have a question about China. Basically, I want to know if you think that it would be better for a Chinese dissident to use Tor, or is it better to use a paid VPN tunnel?
It depends what you're doing. It depends what your threat model is. If you are trying to read web pages, then you're probably okay no matter what you do. But if you're the person organizing that Facebook account, then if you use a paid VPN tunnel, there is some corporation out there who became a corporation in order to make money, and they get to know that you're the one publishing to that Facebook account. So if your attacker goes to Facebook and says, what IP address is this person coming from. Facebook provides it because it's a corporation. They do that. And then your government goes to the VPN provider and says, tell us who this is. That's it. You lose. So if you're using a tool like Tor where you've got distributed trust, so no single relay knows the answer, then you've got anonymity from the service provider as well as the website you're going to. So if you don't need security, you've got a lot of options. But I would argue that more people need security than realize it. There are a lot of situations where things change and you wish you had better anonymity last week. I was talking to a fellow who had been running a proxy for people in Iran, and he ended up with 40,000 people using his proxy every day. And then one day he woke up and said, I can see all of these users. I am the central point of failure. And he shut down his proxy and told them all to use Tor.
Okay, and I have another question as well. Basically, I just want to know your, did you see any change in the China IT intelligence in recent years? Like, has it been much more developed, or what is your take on that?
Part of the challenge is trying to guess what they can do. And we haven't put as much energy into tracking their capabilities as we should. There are a couple of other groups based on Falun Gong developers. There's one called Freegate, one called Ultrasurf. And I was talking to a Freegate guy a while ago. And Freegate mostly gets blocked by fingerprint. They try to look like SSL, but they don't actually look like SSL. So there's some set of bytes in the packets that they send that make them look different. So they get blocked that way. It used to be when China blocked their protocol that they would cut their payload in half and send half of it and see if that got blocked. And then they would binary search to find exactly what the bytes are that get them blocked. And then they would change a few bytes and they wouldn't be blocked anymore. And that doesn't work anymore. Now they cut it in half and neither half gets blocked, but the combination together gets blocked. So that means that the firewall is getting much smarter at being able to put together the pieces it sees and recognize protocols that it doesn't want to see. So that's not a great answer, but it's what I've got.
And that was the alarm bell from my phone telling me that this session is over. I'm sorry that we didn't got enough time for questions. We also had a live chat question, but whoever put that up will probably reach you during the coffee break, because we don't want to eat too much of your coffee break. We need it all. So thank you once again. It was fantastic to listen to you and have a small gift.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'll be around to answer more questions during the coffee break, I guess, among other times.